It is Friday, August the 14th. Good to have you with us here on VOA's International Edition. Coming up, aftermath of deadly explosions at a Chinese hazardous materials warehouse.
There are pollutants that have gotten into the air, but they are saying at this point that it's safe.
Also ahead, the flag to rise above the U.S. Embassy in Havana, plus anti-smoking strategies for TB HIV treatment. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A series of enormous explosions at a hazardous materials warehouse in the northeastern Chinese port city of Tianjin late Wednesday killed at least 50 people, including 17 firemen. Chinese state media say 700 people were injured, with 71 in serious condition. Most of those casualties were among migrant workers who live nearby in residential communities. Emergency personnel are continuing to search for the missing, while a team of more than 200 military specialists experienced in handling nuclear and biochemical materials has been sent from Beijing to assist in all the efforts. VOA's Beijing correspondent Bill Ide is in Tianjin, where I asked him how the city is dealing with the blast.
Well, I think one of the biggest concerns at the moment is, again, the types of hazardous materials that were involved in the explosion and the possibility that these chemicals could be either polluting groundwater or in the air. That's a big concern here right now and on social media, even as far away as Beijing. There are many who are concerned about what is in the air and whether that might have an impact to individuals' health. We've heard authorities talking about confirming that, yes, there are pollutants that have gotten into the air, but they are saying at this point that it's safe. There was just a CCTV report that I heard state television. They were talking about how at the blast site there were levels that exceed what is normal, but the surrounding area is safe, they say. And perhaps that is because the wind is blowing offshore at this point, and it's expected that that will continue. But if the wind shifts, then that might be another concern.
I know that you've been to the blast zone or very near it and seen for yourself what happened. Just your impression of what this did to the neighboring area.
Well, when you see it up close or get as close as you can get, you really get a sense of how powerful the blast was. Just looking at the buildings and the number of windows that had been blown out and glass all over the streets, parked buses that have been partially or completely destroyed, windows have been blown out of them. And this is a good distance away from where the blast site is. If you see aerial footage of the blast site, there's a huge crater there, and you know everything around it is decimated, burnt out. There are thousands of cars that were destroyed in the blast. And so when you get up close, you really get a feeling of just how powerful this explosion was.
Have you been able to speak with any of the people who were there when this happened?
We've been able to speak to quite a few people. One individual that we unfortunately wasn't willing to talk too long, but was we happened to run into at a restaurant while we were grabbing some lunch, had a head injury and arm injury, and he was there with his what appeared to be his girlfriend or wife, and they had, like many, you know, felt the quake. It felt like an earthquake, they say, and then they tried to get back into their home and grab a few things before after the first explosion, and that was when they got injured. And what we're seeing and hearing from reports is that a lot of injuries are either someone has been hit by objects or things have fallen on them because of the extent and the magnitude of the blast.
So far, are the authorities giving any idea of what caused these explosions?
Well, we understand that it's a mix of a fire and these hazardous chemicals. What I think is interesting is that, and I was just checking on this, is that the Tianjin Police social media website says that at about 10:52, more than a half an hour before the blast occurred, there was a fire that was going on, and firefighters were rushed in, and they were fighting this fire. It seems interesting or curious that they were fighting this fire, but maybe perhaps they did not know, you know, what kind of chemicals they were dealing with, and it makes you wonder whether or not there is some connection between that and the blast.
That is VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide speaking to us from Tianjin, China. And we turn now to Ji Abby Lee, who's here with what's going on in social media about these blasts. Hey, Ji.
Hi, Steve. High-level Washington officials are not tweeting about the blast, but the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's spokesperson did. Mr. Ban's spokesperson's office is on Twitter at UN_spokesperson. The account tweeted, hashtag UNSG deeply saddened by loss of life and injuries to scores of people as a result of deadly explosions in Tianjin, China.
I see. Anyone else?
You know, one person I expected to hear a statement from is Pope Francis, but he hasn't tweeted anything about it yet. And moving on to what China's state-run Xinhua News Agency tweeted, it wrote on Twitter Thursday that air quality is normal after hashtag Tianjin blast, toxic fumes within national standards. And that tweet got a lot of attention because China is not exactly known for its clean air, so some people replied to the tweet with simply, quote, national standards, unquote, to show sarcasm, and other people elaborated more. A user with the handle at Hong Kong Hermit asked, toxic fumes within national standards, so still deadly poisonous then? And there were so many other comments like that. Now, before I go, I want to mention that hashtag Tianjin was used nearly 39,000 times, and hashtag Tianjin Blast was used in more than 6,500 tweets during the last 24 hours. That's according to the social media analytics website Topsy. Steve?
Many thanks, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. Here's a reminder for you. You can follow International Edition on Twitter if you'd like. We can be found at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Iraqi officials say a powerful truck bomb tore through a Shiite neighborhood of Baghdad on Thursday, killing dozens in one of the capital's largest bomb attacks in months. More were wounded when a refrigerated truck packed with explosives was detonated at the crowded Jamila market that's in Sadr City, according to officials. Islamic State militants say they were responsible for that attack. Graham Bannerman is a scholar at the Middle East Institute here in Washington. International Edition's Jeffrey Young asked him what's behind this attack and what it means for the U.S. role in the region.
Well, I think it's a question of the Islamic State is trying to attack the Shias all over the Middle East, and this is just one more example of that. I mean, the bombing attacks in Saudi Arabia were against Shias, and in Kuwait were against Shias. They see this as a existential struggle between the Shias and the Sunnis, and this is just another example of that.
I also get the sense that because obviously we have Haider al-Hadi, who is Shia and a member of the Dawa party, running the government in Baghdad, and we have such a huge bombing taking place in the Iraqi capital, in a sense, isn't this also kind of a slight toward the government and al-Hadi in saying you can't even protect your own capital?
Well, that's the purpose of all of these things, is to demonstrate that the Shia government of Iraq, which the Islamic State sees as governing the country, cannot protect its people, cannot govern, and therefore should be replaced. It's part of that undermining of the current Iraqi government by the Islamic State.
Outgoing U.S. Army Chief of Staff General Ray Odierno said on Wednesday that Washington should consider embedding American troops with Iraqi forces if the Baghdad government doesn't make progress against the Islamic State. Well, we have a few technical problems here, don't we? Isn't there a matter of a status of forces agreement and indemnification of American forces?
Well, it's more than technical problems. There's the problem for our military is they've been assigned a task in Iraq that they don't think they can accomplish with the current restrictions. Therefore, being good soldiers that they are, they want to accomplish their task, and this is one way they think they can do that. The problem is Washington, as an institution, does not have the political will at this point to get more involved in Iraq. In fact, there's grave reservations among many people in Washington saying we've been there too long, it's been too much, and our policy cannot succeed. And there's also a part of this game of blaming the other party. The Democrats are saying the problem is the Republicans went in 2003, and the Republicans are saying, no, the problem is that the president withdrew the troops too early in 2011. And so, therefore, we're having this political battle in Washington, and there is no will here to take a more vigorous military actions at this time.
Let me add another factor to this whole thing. The vital necessity for coordinated strategy between American forces, if they're going to be there, and Iraqi forces. What about this? We haven't really had a very coordinated strategy so far in this fight against the Islamic State, have we?
We have attempted to coordinate our bombing with their needs. The problem we have, though, is the Iranian factor. Because this government in Baghdad is a Shia government and closely aligned with Iran, we find ourselves being on the same side of the battle with a country that we don't have very much in common with at this time, and of which is the political football in Washington right now as the treaty with Iran is being debated vigorously in Congress and around the city.
That is Graham Bannerman, a scholar at the Middle East Institute here in Washington, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Well, also in the news, U.S. and Cuban officials gathering in Havana today to watch Marines hoist the U.S. flag at the American Embassy, a move that marks a ceremonial reopening of this facility. It's part of the broader U.S.-Cuba reengagement. But some say the new U.S. engagement with Cuba is too much too soon. VOA's Pam Dawkins has our story.
As onlookers watched, Cuba raised its flag at the newly reestablished embassy in Washington in July. Now it's the U.S. turn to host a ceremony, although the U.S. embassy in Havana actually opened in July as well. The newly expanded engagement between the two countries may result in only minor changes for the average Cuban because the U.S. trade embargo remains in effect, says international relations professor Philip Brenner. Still, he says, the change is significant.
President Obama did an extraordinary act by empathizing with Cuba and, in some sense, with Iran. And that is the way the United States is going to succeed in the future.
But as the Cuban government continues its clampdown on dissidents, some say the U.S. should have held back on efforts to normalize ties until Cuba showed a greater human rights commitment. Anti-Castro activist Frank Calzone spoke with VOA via Skype.
The Castro government has been emboldened by the engagement of the United States because the administration has yet to pressure the Cuban government on the issue of human rights.
It's a view shared by a Cuban-American lawmaker.
We are so hungry for this deal that we're willing to overlook 100 peaceful dissidents arrested just a few hours before the opening of our embassy. It is atrocious.
State Department officials say the embassy reopening and the stepped-up engagement with Cuba will give the U.S. a broader platform to raise human rights concerns and other issues with the Cuban government.
That is VOA's Pam Dawkins. Pam is in Havana, where she will be there with Secretary of State John Kerry as he raises later today the American flag over the U.S. embassy. Supporters of the Castro regime are presenting the restoration of diplomatic relations with Washington as a victory for Cuba. VOA's Jerome Sokolowski has more.
The reestablishment of relations comes as Cuba is still struggling to recover from an economic crisis that began in the 90s with the collapse of the Soviet Union. But it's not a defeat for Cuban communism, says former revolutionary fighter Eladio Aguiar, who fought against the CIA-led invasion at the Bay of Pigs.
Quizás algunos soñadores u otros.
Perhaps some dreamers or others who are superficial think this will be the end of socialism and think that with the demise of the historic generation, socialism in Cuba will be over. But it's not like that.
In fact, the government is selling the agreement to the people as a victory, and many are buying it, says dissident artist Tania Bruguera.
You walk the street and talk to taxi drivers or people waiting in line, and they say, Cuba is setting the terms here, and the U.S. is giving in to all its demands.
Bruguera says the U.S. should now push for democracy to be established in Cuba. That's only a matter of time, says another dissident artist whose work has been compared to Picasso's.
You have to start somewhere, and I believe this is a good start.
The history between the United States and Cuba.
President Barack Obama wants engagement to accomplish what 50 years of isolation have failed to do. And both supporters and opponents of the revolution have taken note.
VOA's Jerome Sokolowski reporting. There's a new study out there. It's calling for urgent action to integrate anti-smoking strategies into tuberculosis, HIV, and TB-HIV care. International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease released the report this week that identifies critical missed opportunities in TB and HIV programs. Smoking and exposure to secondhand smoke are known to exacerbate these diseases. Dr. Angela Jackson Morris is the lead author of the study, and she spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the urgency to include anti-smoking measures in TB treatment programs.
For some years, the union and other organizations have attempted to get the message across that TB and HIV care must start to incorporate anti-smoking strategies. We know that more people who smoke end up having TB. Treatment is less effective. We know that there are more smokers amongst people with TB and HIV. And we know that treatment, again, for antiretroviral therapy is less effective if people smoke. So we see this as critical because, in a sense, we are failing patients if we are just treating them but not preventing this ultimately preventable issue that will stop them living a good quality of life with HIV or getting better from TB if they continue to smoke. And the issue applies as well if they're exposed to secondhand smoke in the home.
In your study, you point out some practical measures that you recommend to be incorporated into treatment programs. What are some of those measures?
There are things like monitoring whether the patients that you see are smokers or ex-smokers are still smoking so that you can then follow up with them and the other healthcare workers can provide appropriate support. It's making sure that you've got, for example, a smoke-free environment, so a smoke-free healthcare facility, a smoke-free hospital, and also the workers who see patients at home, encouraging family members to not smoke in the home or around the patient and explaining to them that effectively their loved one, their family member, won't get better from TB and won't be successful on their antiretroviral therapy if they've still got this secondhand smoke around them. So that's important. And a critical one, I think, as you would expect, would be cessation. That would be working with patients, so identifying who is still smoking and giving them the appropriate support to stop. Another thing that is an issue that we see in some healthcare environments is where managers can be under pressure from tobacco industry representatives, for example, to take sponsorship. So again, it would be making sure with the hospital managers, the healthcare facility managers, that that kind of thing doesn't happen. And that way people aren't inadvertently exposed to tobacco advertising when they go, for example, to their local clinic, which would be anathema to what the healthcare workers are trying to do for the patients and their families.
You also emphasize it's important that urgent action is needed in integrating these anti-smoking strategies. So how would you go about getting this accomplished, say, for instance, in countries in Africa?
I think the paper is a start. What we're trying to do is to reach particularly TB and HI practitioners and just get the message across to them that we do not see this as being a complex thing to integrate into their day-to-day work. We know that they're busy. We know that they see many patients and costs are an issue. And that's why these strategies, we know, will be more effective. It will help them in their duty of care to the patients and their families in terms of being more effective in getting patients better. So what we would suggest is that the paper is a start in getting the message out there. What we're going to be doing, what the union is doing in the countries in which we work in and other countries, WHO, is now working harder to try and get this message across so that people, for example, in charge of hospitals, healthcare facilities, take a lead on making their healthcare environment smoke-free, that individual practitioners get together and identify how in the treatment and the care process they will work to identify smoking patients, to give them the advice and the support to stop and to do the same at home with their families.
Dr. Angela Jackson-Morris is the lead author of the study on anti-smoking strategies for the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease. She was speaking from Edinburgh, Scotland, with VOA's Kim Lewis. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Russian microbiologists have found that a new strain of yeast was quite effective in treating wastewater that contains certain toxic chemical compounds. Conducting their research at peat bogs in western Siberia, the scientists from Kazan Federal University found that this new yeast strain was effective in eliminated nitro compounds. These organic compounds are commonly used in such products as explosives, insecticides, polymers, dyes, and some medications. The scientists focused on a waste product called trinitrotoline, which is known to be a serious health threat. High numbers of this nitro compound waste are produced by industries such as oil refineries and military equipment manufacturers. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for being with us. Now a little something from the world of music, where rappers Jay-Z and Timbaland will be in court next month. It's that 16-year-old lawsuit over their mega hit, Big Pimpin'. It turns out that International Edition spoke with one of our special people here, VOA's Soul Lounge host, Shauna Renee, about the lawsuit, which has the rappers embroiled in a morass involving Egyptian law, song rights, movie, soundtracks, and millions of dollars.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Jay-Z and Timbaland were in the studio, and Timbaland grabbed a CD that contained a Middle Eastern-inspired riff, or just a tune that he believed to be public domain, which meant that it was available to use without any condition, any payment whatsoever. So it turns out, however, that that song was from a 1960s Egyptian film called Fateh Ahlami. And that, in fact, the song did need to be paid for. EMI, who is responsible for rights and all these kinds of things, said that they indeed had to pay for use of this portion of the song. So Timbaland and Jay-Z and the record company paid $100,000 for the use of this very short version or piece of the song, and thought that at this point, all was well. This happens all the time, especially in hip hop. We sample music, bits of music, you pay for it, you keep it moving. Well, it turns out that the family members of the original composer, Bahli Hamdi, said that they, in fact, are owed more money because EMI did not have a right to allow Timbaland and Jay-Z to use this sample in what we have to say is probably one of Jay-Z's biggest songs.
TMC, Jigga Man. You know I thug them, hug them, love them, leave them, but I don't trust or need them. Take them out the hood, keep them looking good, with diamond cuffs that'll freeze them. First time they fuss, I'm breezing. Talk about what's the reasons. I'm a pimpin' every sense in the word, mama. Better trust and believe them. In the cut where I keep them, till I need the wood, till I need to beat it up, then it's BB, then I'm picking them up, then I play with it quick in the truck.
There's no denying that they used this portion of the song.
Right.
They admitted they paid for it. Now, the question is how much was made from it and whether or not the family has a right to say or can say legally, we did not give EMI permission to allow Timbaland and Jay-Z to use. And Timbaland and Jay-Z will be testifying in this case. So this is going to be something that we'll be talking about for a while.
Oh, boy, the drama continues. Well, if you have any comments on this, you can send a tweet to Shauna. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also send one to at VOA underscore music. You can send one to us at VOA underscore IE. And, of course, you can catch Shauna in the Soul Lounge. Log on to our website. That's voanews.com.
Yeah, it was a big hit for them, so I could imagine this would end up in the court somehow or another. Another quick story for you. The U.S. government has formally returned a painting by Pablo Picasso valued at $15 million that had been stolen from a Paris museum more than a decade ago and seized by immigration officials late last year in the U.S. state of New Jersey. The painting was on its way from Belgium to New York, the borough of Queens, when it was identified and seized in Newark, New Jersey last December. $15 million for one painting. Amazing. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On August 21, 2013, Syrian government forces committed a heinous atrocity. They attacked the civilian population of the Damascus suburb of Ghouta with sarin gas, a chemical weapon that affects the nervous system. Over 1,000 Syrians, including hundreds of young children, died and thousands more were injured. The act was immediately and universally condemned and prompted the threat of U.S. military strikes. Consequently, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was brought to the negotiating table. The Kerry Lavrov framework, along with increased international pressure, induced Syria to join the Chemical Weapons Convention and relinquish its declared stockpiles of chemical weapons. These were then shipped out of Syria and destroyed. However, nobody was held accountable for the terrible deaths of thousands of Syrians on August 21, 2013. Attacks against Syrian civilians have continued, now using mostly chlorine gas delivered in barrel bombs dropped out of helicopters. On August 7th, nearly 2 years after the Ghouta attack, the United Nations Security Council unanimously adopted Resolution 2235. It establishes a joint investigation mechanism to identify in the Syrian Arab Republic individuals, entities, groups, or governments who were perpetrators, organizers, sponsors, or otherwise involved in the use of chemicals as weapons, including chlorine or any other toxic chemical. This mechanism would come into play once the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons fact-finding mission determines that a specific incident in Syria involved or likely involved the use of chemicals as weapons. The goal is to create a shared international factual basis for eventual accountability. Until we adopted today's resolution, there was no mechanism to take the obvious next step, determining who was involved in such attacks. Even when there were obvious signs pointing to the parties responsible, investigators were not empowered to point the finger. This has compounded an already rampant sense of impunity in Syria, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Samantha Power. To those who think that impunity will last forever for the perpetrators and all others involved in chemical weapons attacks, those who order chemical attacks, those who fill munitions with chemicals, those who drop chemical weapons, look at all of the perpetrators today who find themselves being forced to answer for acts committed years or even decades ago, she said. The evidence gathered by the Joint Investigative Mechanism will stand as a record not just of what has been done, but of who has done it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.